This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hong Kong marks the 25th anniversary of post-British rule today, as many Hong Kongers lament what they've lost under Chinese rule.
People in Hong Kong can no longer enjoy the freedom as like before because the greatest safeguard, judicial independence, has gone.
Also today, with food and fuel prices climbing, people in some nations are taking to the streets.
What you're seeing in a lot of countries around the world is that people are blaming the thing they can see, their own government.
And the UK has adopted a new plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda. Some say it violates human rights, and the plan is now on hold. But people in Rwanda say they're ready for the migrants.
I don't know why they're not even here yet, because we want them to come. We want them to come and see how beautiful this country is.
I'm Carol Hills. That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. 25 years ago, just before the stroke of midnight, the British flag was lowered for the final time in Hong Kong. God Save the Queen played to mark the end of 150 years of British rule, and the UK handed Hong Kong back to China on July 1st, 1997. Today, 25 years later, Hong Kong's new chief executive, John Lee, was sworn in. China's President Xi Jinping was on hand. It marked Xi's first visit to the island since pro-democracy protests were crushed in 2019. Our next guest, Eric Lai, says democracy has eroded dramatically in Hong Kong over the past 25 years. He's a Hong Kong law fellow at Georgetown University. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you, Carol.
The 25-year anniversary today marked President Xi's first visit to Hong Kong since the end of pro-democracy protests. What kind of message does this visit send to the people of Hong Kong?
Xi Jinping's visit to Hong Kong this year gives a very strong message. Although he said the one country, two systems formula shall continue in Hong Kong, but he qualified it as only patriots can enter the system and govern Hong Kong, which is completely different from the people's expectation of Hong Kongers governing Hong Kong back in 25 years ago.
Remind us what the one country, two systems deal was supposed to provide.
It was supposed to provide to the Hong Kong people that once Hong Kong is returned to China in 1997 under the Chinese sovereignty, Hong Kong people can still enjoy their existing systems from the British colonial government, including the common law, including a capitalist market economy, and people's freedoms and rights can continue to exist in Hong Kong. And ultimately, Beijing promised us to the Hong Kong people that Hong Kong could have a full democracy in the future, and it is written in the basic law. And now, in Xi Jinping's interpretation of patriots, it is obvious that it excludes all the pro-democracy leaders. It excludes people who appreciate the basic rights and freedoms in Hong Kong. And that's why, if you see last year, when the Chinese government imposed a new electoral system on Hong Kong, it excludes all the possibilities for opposition to run for elections.
Who is John Lee, the new chief executive of Hong Kong, who was sworn in today?
John Lee was a cop in Hong Kong, and he became the head of the Security Bureau in Hong Kong in the previous administration. And after the national security law was imposed in Hong Kong, he took an active role in arresting political activists and to order the freezing of assets of some companies like the Apple Daily and the local newspaper, the Stand News, and to continue to enhance different national security institutions in Hong Kong.
The imposition of the national security law has really changed things in Hong Kong. Just give a brief summary of what that law means.
This law is an absolute political instrument for the Chinese authorities to crack down on all potential enemies of the state, meaning those pro-democracy forces, civil society, and independent media outlets in Hong Kong. And the governments had already used the law to arrest more than 200 key figures in civil society and in the pro-democracy movement. And you can see this is a way to silence Hong Kong society and to make Hong Kong no longer be open and free as before.
What risks do people in Hong Kong face for speaking out or showing any disagreement with the Chinese or Hong Kong government?
I can give you two examples. Two ordinary citizens were just sent to jail before 6 months and 8 months respectively, simply because they made social media posts against the government vaccination policy, and the government arrested these people in the name of national security. Another example is that there are more than 30 pro-democracy leaders being denied bail and have been remanded without a trial for more than 1 year, simply because the court said that these people would continue to endanger national security. And the evidence was so ridiculous, it includes because they had communications with foreign diplomats or foreign journalists.
Hong Kong has remained a global financial center for much of the last 25 years. Does the international presence there have an influence on what happens in Hong Kong?
This is a very good question. Ironically, the economic success and financial success of Hong Kong in the past was dependent on the values that President Xi disapproves today, including the rule of law, freedom of speech, and judicial independence, and a democratic, accountable government. And now, when all these values are gone, international businesses would inevitably lose confidence, and they would reconsider whether investing in Hong Kong fits their best interest.
We've seen many Hong Kongers flee the city, those who were able to in the last few years. How has that changed Hong Kong?
It is the second time when there is a massive departure of people from Hong Kong for relocation. And this time, there are many reports said that there are hundreds and thousands of people are relocating to the UK, to Australia, to elsewhere. They feel it's a safer place and a freer societies for their benefits as well as for their children. And it is obvious that in the future, Hong Kong's competitiveness would be significantly reduced, not because of the people's migration, but because of the government's hardline policies to crack down on Hong Kong that made many people decide to leave.
What's it like for you to observe the changes in your home city of Hong Kong from afar?
It is a very difficult question to answer because I do feel sad of Hong Kong turning into a city with a great loss of its freedoms, of its robustness and vibrancy. It's not just about political crackdown. It's also about the city losing its plurality and its openness to make this city as vibrant as before.
What do you miss most about your city?
I miss a lot of things, to be honest. I miss my friends and my former colleagues who worked hard in Hong Kong civil society and in the pro-democracy movement. Many of them were exiled from Hong Kong or now in jail waiting for trials, and they would not know when will their trial begin or how long will they be sentenced, because the governments now see them as the enemies. But what they have done was simply to advance the common good in Hong Kong by promoting democracy and political freedoms.
Eric Lai is a Hong Kong Law Fellow at Georgetown University. Eric, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you, Carol, and thank you, everyone.
Now we turn to a problem plaguing much of the world right now, inflation. To try to tame that, dozens of central banks across the globe are raising interest rates. The idea is straightforward. Higher inflation rates help cool off an economy, which then lowers inflation. But it's a delicate balancing act. Raising interest rates too aggressively can tip an economy into a recession. Jean-Claude Trichet knows this dance well. He's a former president of the European Central Bank who steered Europe through the 2008 financial crisis. Jean-Claude Trichet, inflation is stubbornly high across much of the world. Is it going to get worse, or are we at the peak?
Well, it's very difficult, of course, to decide whether it is the peak or not. What is absolutely sure is that only 6 months ago, the central bankers did not imagine for one second that there would be a hump of inflation. They thought it was transitory. And if inflation expectations medium term are not correctly anchored, then we could have the spiraling of inflation. And we could be back in a very, very bad situation. We see now that it was not transitory at all.
Raising interest rates, of course, can set off a recession, but it can also bring down inflation. How do you make that decision about when to raise interest rates?
If investors and savers have in mind that in 4 years' time, 3 years' time, inflation would be at 6% or 7% or 8%, we are totally lost because all their decision will be taken incorporating a very high level of inflation. They would create themselves long-lasting inflation, which is a recipe for ultimate catastrophe. So the central banks, as far as I see it, on both sides of the Atlantic, are concentrating their credibility and their decisions to re-anchor inflation expectations to avoid this spiraling I was mentioning. So in any case, the central banks have to increase rates in the present situation. That's clear.
Are you saying that if you talk about inflation going up and expect it to go up, then it will go up?
Yes. Yes, indeed. You summed up very, very well exactly the problem. If everybody, every economic agent, every decision maker is reflecting that on the medium term, inflation will be again at a very high level, then they create inflation themselves. If they are convinced that the central bank is credible, if the Fed and the ECB are trusted,
and of course the ECB is the European Central Bank,
then we are in a different universe. We avoid the long-lasting hump of inflation, which we had experienced in the past and which can be very catastrophic.
When inflation is happening in so many countries like it is now, is there a value to central banks coordinating their efforts with each other?
It's not at all a normal position, but the central banks are meeting very, very often. But a joint augmentation of interest rates or a joint diminishing of interest rates, which happened in my time because we were in the Lehman Brothers drama, is not at all thinkable at the present moment. So it's very, very important to compare notes and be sure that you understand how your partners are reasoning.
You've alluded to this, but part of what central bank chiefs do is send a message about what's coming, and that can be enough to calm things down. You became well known for that kind of telegraphing yourself when you were president of the European Central Bank. Does that kind of messaging still do the trick?
It's very important, of course, to prepare the market for the decisions that you're likely to take. The same in Europe. We know in advance that normally the European Central Bank will augment rates. You see, there is some kind of pre-announcement, preparation. It is obviously important not to surprise too dramatically the market when you have a clear idea of what should be done.
When you're in a position of weighing these kinds of policy decisions, which you were back in 2008, is it stressful?
Yes, it's always very stressful. That's clear. That's clear because you have to find the appropriate balance, and you have also no decision without negative aspects. So for my colleagues in the central bank constituency, it seems to me that the situation is extremely difficult.
Jean-Claude Trichet is the former president of the European Central Bank. He was at the helm during the 2008 financial crisis. Jean-Claude Trichet, thank you so much.
Thank you, madam.
Later this hour, we'll take a further look at inflation and how it's leading to civil unrest in several places around the globe. But just ahead, what's caused the fires burning near the ancient ruins of Machu Picchu? You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Firefighters in Peru are battling a blaze near the Machu Picchu archaeological site. The cause? Farmers burning their fields to prepare to plant their crops. It's an indigenous tradition dating back centuries, but now it's raising questions and concerns among some environmental activists. To understand this practice of agricultural burning, we got in touch with Diego Caruaricua. He's a coordinator of the Permaculture Center with the Chaikuni Institute. He joins us from the jungle of central Peru. Diego, first of all, can you give us an update on the fires right now near Machu Picchu?
They're being really difficult to control, and there's fires all over the Peru, all over the jungles, all over South America. They're constantly battling against it. They're still trying to battle and control the surroundings of the Machu Picchu area, but it's a really difficult task to do because it's such a big land and it's not that accessible by land. So it will take maybe weeks to control it.
What exactly is agricultural burning, and who practices this tradition?
This has been practicing since maybe thousands of years, and it is actually the most efficient way to produce food. And it's efficient because you burn all the organic matter above the ground, and while burning, a lot of fertilized organic matter comes to the ground, and then you can grow crops really fast. The big issue is that right now it's being uncontrolled. Those holes that are poked in the ground are too big now, are too close to each other, so that the land itself, the jungle itself, is really, really difficult to regrow by themselves. And now the big issue is that the grassland is starting to take over. So instead of the jungle regenerating the holes, now the grass that grows into the holes are taking over to the jungle.
But why is this a problem now and it hasn't been in the past? Is it more people are burning their crops at the same time? And why isn't it more kind of controlled?
From my perspective, there's many, many, many layers of problems that have been constantly growing. It starts from poverty, from people that understood the need to bring food to their families. So they need places to grow food. And other is the overpopulation now in the villagers that we used to have between 50 to 100 villagers that controlled over 100 hectares. Now there's triple or five times before, and they need to feed more people. The other one, the uncontrolled economy, which makes some things, basic things, really expensive. So for them to have food and also to have an income so they can buy the rest of the things that they need to produce a lot more. So I think there's many layers.
So given the concern over these fires, what can be done about it, or what is being done about it?
What is being done is one of them we're doing in Chaikuni. We train a lot of villagers who wants to join us and try to produce food without slash and burning. And so they have around between 5 to 10 hectares each family. So what's been happening now, which is amazing, is that most families that have finished the program and have 3 or 4 years with us, they tried 10 or 20% of their whole land with our program. And now they realize that it's working. So now they're moving towards their full area to be produced in a reforestation way.
And your approach is a completely different approach. It's not controlling or timing agricultural burning. It's a whole other practice.
It's thinking with the family what they will need in 5, 8, or 10 years ahead for their family. So what they do is if they have a land close to their house, we produce an agroforestry system in the hectares that they want to produce, focused mostly on food and medicine. So they will have 1 or 2 hectares really close to their home with food to be harvested within 5, 6, 8 years. And if they have land further from their house, usually they focus on more timber or bamboo or medicinal plants that they can have really few maintenance over the first years, and they can have a big harvest in the long term.
Diego Caruaricua is a coordinator of the Permaculture Center with the Chaikuni Institute in Peru. We've been talking about fires that are burning near the ancient site of Machu Picchu, fires that started from a practice of farmers burning their fields. Diego, thank you so much.
Thank you too.
You may recall this scene from the Polish-Belarus border last November. Hundreds of people, mostly men, trying to force their way through a fence and into Poland and the European Union. They'd emigrated to Belarus from the Middle East, South Asia, and Africa. In response to the chaos at the border, Poland's government began to build a border wall. Yesterday, the government announced that the wall is now complete. It's made of steel slats, 18 feet tall and 115 miles long. Poland's prime minister visited the wall and said it is necessary to protect the Polish border. Not everyone in Poland agrees. Kalina Czwarnog is with the NGO Fundacja Ocalenia, in English, the Rescue Foundation. She joins us now from just outside Olsztyn in Poland. Kalina, your organization advocates for migrants. Remind us what exactly happened along the border with Belarus last November.
Actually, people who were crossing into Poland from Belarus, they weren't migrants in Belarus. They were just crossing into EU through Belarus. So in November, when thousands of people shown in Kuznica border crossing, they were gathered there by the Belarusian border guards. It wasn't their idea. They were actually forced to do so by the Belarusian border guards.
Why did the Polish government choose to build a wall?
I think the building of the wall is just a propaganda move. You know, when people are scared, they will listen to you if you tell them that you have a solution. And this is what's happening.
Kalina, you've compared Poland's response to migration from Belarus with its response to people arriving from Ukraine. Talk about that.
We are also, Ocalenie is also working on Ukrainian border since the first week of the war. And it was shocking for us to see the difference in how Polish border guards behaves in those two places, which are not very far from another, right? On the Ukrainian border, Polish border guards carry small children through the border. They are, you know, welcoming. People get free food, free toys for kids, free clothes, free SIM cards. It's shocking. It's like being in a parallel universe from the Belarusian border where people are hunted like animals.
And of course, there's no wall along Poland's border with Ukraine. Why is Poland's response to migrants from Belarus so different from migrants arriving from Ukraine?
That's very easy. People who are crossing into Poland from the Belarusian border, they come from Middle East, they come from sometimes African countries, sometimes Central Asia. And I think the only difference between the Ukrainians and those people is the color of their skin.
Kalina, has the experience of Poland welcoming the millions of Ukrainian migrants, has it changed their view of what's happening along the border with Belarus?
Yes. Many people who were hesitant towards the refugees who are coming from the Belarusian border, now they are changing the way how they feel about it. And they feel that we should also welcome people from the Belarusian border the same way as we did with the Ukrainians, because they see that this is not a big risk, this is not a burden. So why shouldn't we treat those people equally?
Is the Polish government listening to that sentiment?
So far, no. As we can see from the building of the wall, Polish government is still deciding to keep their racist rhetoric.
Kalina Szmarnog is with the NGO Fundacja Ocalenia. She was telling us about the treatment of migrants in Poland, where a new wall has been built along the border with Belarus. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is The World. Ukraine has a strong history of feminism.
You know, if they didn't have a man, it was okay. The family was not going to starve having an extra mouth to feed that year.
With the war, Ukrainian women have also taken up the fight.
I really hope that we will see women entering position of power and maybe women generals in the Ukrainian army.
Women in Ukraine, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Nearly 30,000 people crossed the English Channel in small boats last year, seeking asylum in the United Kingdom. They largely came from the Middle East, East Africa, and Afghanistan. This spring, the UK devised a plan to send these migrants to the African nation of Rwanda. Refugee advocates condemn the plan as inhumane. They say it pushes responsibility to a country with fewer resources. And European courts halted the practice before it started. But as Ridwan Karim Dini Osman reports from Rwanda, many people there are ready to welcome the asylum seekers.
In the Rwandan capital, Kigali, dozens of motorbikes dot the streets. It is one of the major and most popular means of transportation here. Jenny Mizewa has just jumped off one of the motorbikes. He heads straight to his house, which is few meters from a local market where traders display food items like bananas, onions, and tomatoes. Mizewa is 27. He was born a year after the Rwandan genocide in 1994 that claimed the lives of some 800,000 people, including some of his relatives.
I've moved on, and I forgave those who did the killing.
He believes Rwanda can now be a desired destination for refugees.
It's a country that's developing so fast, first of all. We've been in bad times. They should come and see what we've been accomplished in 28 years.
Human Rights Watch claims that serious abuses still go on in Rwanda, including suppression of free speech and arbitrary detention. But Evariste Murwanashaka disagrees. He is program manager of the umbrella of human rights organizations in Rwanda. He says no human rights will be violated in implementing the deal, and the country is prepared to integrate refugees into society.
Rwanda will facilitate them to live as Rwandans so that they can get a job if available.
A hostel located in the capital, Kigali, has already been prepared to receive the refugees from the UK. Murwanashaka has had access to the building.
Everything is inside. Water and the other all facilities near hospitals, near schools, everything is there.
But other analysts disagree. Some point to the country's youth unemployment rate, nearly 24% at the end of 2021.
And refugees, when repatriated, would wish to be integrated into a free, just, equitable society.
That's international relations and security expert Adib Sani, based in Ghana. He points to concerns about Rwanda's alleged support of rebels in neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo. That's why he doesn't support the migrants' deal with the UK.
And so if you move them into Rwanda and their basic rights are not guaranteed, then you can only expect inhumane treatment, and that defeats the purpose of having to even repatriate them to Rwanda in the first place.
But Rwandan President Paul Kagame insists the country has a track record of taking refugees. Rwanda is already home to about 150,000 refugees from other African countries, including neighboring Burundi and DR Congo. It also hosts migrants who try to cross the Mediterranean to Europe via Libya. He addressed the issue at a recent meeting with Commonwealth heads of government.
We received requests that people were looking for where to go because they were fleeing what happened in Afghanistan, and we accepted these people. These people are still here. They are attending school. Here we try to do our best to give them a sense of security and normalcy.
President Kagame also took a swipe at those who have questioned the country's human rights credentials.
Those from the north who always think they are the face of values, the rest have to follow. We have values too. We here in Rwanda, in Africa, we do. No question about it.
Rwanda's government says it is ready to absorb 1,000 asylum seekers from the UK, but has the capacity for many more. The UN's refugee agency is skeptical. It says it is concerned the East African country won't be able to manage arrivals from the UK because it has too few lawyers, case workers, and interpreters to deal with them. back at Jenny Mizewe's home, he says he can't wait to receive the arrival of the refugees. He hopes they will find all the love and comfort that sent them to the UK here.
We are ready to receive them. We were happy to have them here. I don't know why they are not even here yet, because we want them to come. We want them to come and see how beautiful this country is.
The first transfer of asylum seekers slated for this month was blocked in a European court, but UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson says he will continue to pursue the deal. For the world, I am Ridwan Karim Dini Osman, Kigali, Rwanda.
Stocks are battered, food and oil prices are soaring, and there remains growing concerns that a global recession could follow. That potent mix is causing protests from Sri Lanka to Peru and Pakistan, and there's fear that political unrest will erupt in other places too. Robert Guest is The Economist's foreign editor. He's been following these trends. Robert, the war in Ukraine and the 2+ years of a pandemic are two obvious reasons why living standards are being crushed, but you've found that increasingly people are blaming their own governments. What's happening?
So the reason that food and fuel prices are going up so sharply in the world, it's mostly Vladimir Putin's fault for invading Ukraine and interrupting the supply. But what you're seeing in a lot of countries around the world is that people are blaming the thing they can see, their own government. And food and fuel price inflation are particularly destabilizing. And it's particularly a problem in poor countries. You know, when the cost of food and fuel goes up in rich countries, it's bad. People don't like it. In poor countries, it can be catastrophic because they spend so much more of a portion of the household budget on basics like food and getting to work. And unlike other kinds of inflation, you know, if the price of furniture or iPhones goes up, you can always not buy one or delay the purchase. But with food, you can't not eat for a week. You have to eat. So this goes straight to people's living standards, and it's making them very angry.
So you went to Turkey and Tunisia. Let's talk about Turkey first. Did the men and women you spoke to, do they have a point? Is the Turkish government to blame?
In this case, yes. I mean, in all places, you have global inflation, and that comes on top of local grievances. In the case of Turkey, President Erdogan believes, unlike every reputable economist in the world, that the cure for high inflation is low interest rates. Inflation is a huge problem for pensioners because they tend to have a fixed income. And I talked to people in the marketplaces. There was one couple who said that their pension had been so gobbled away by inflation that they hadn't eaten meat all year. So people are falling out of the middle class and they're very angry with their government.
What about Tunisia? Is the government there contributing to the problem?
So in Tunisia, your starting point is they're very dependent on imported wheat for their bread. And you've got very high youth unemployment and lots of young men who are either unemployed or underemployed. And I talked to people. There was one guy in a cafe who said that his wages had just been crushed by inflation, and he didn't see how he was going to be able to afford to get married anytime in the future. And for him, that was of crucial importance because he figured that if you're not married and with children, you're not really a grown up and people don't respect you. And he's saying, you know, his life was just not starting and that he woke up. And from the moment he woke up in the morning until the time he went to sleep at night, he was angry.
And of course, half the population in Tunisia is under 30. So this is a pretty serious problem there.
Yeah, there's a huge number of young men you find, particularly in the slums around the capital, who don't have very much to do, don't have very much money, don't have very much hope for the future. And they see that, you know, their president has tried to seize undemocratic power recently. And they used to support him. They used to think that he was a good thing. But now they're angry. And they, you know, it doesn't take long in a conversation before they start saying they got nothing to lose.
Did you get the sense that it's just a matter of time before these kind of complaints translate into political unrest?
Well, in some countries, it's already happening. In Sri Lanka, you've seen large riots. You've seen big demonstrations in Pakistan, where the prime minister has been chucked out. It seems inevitable that, at least in some countries, It's going to happen. We, at The Economist, we did a model feeding in food and fuel price inflation, the vulnerability to, you know, the dependence on imports in countries. And it basically spat out that if, you know, historical connections between these two variables continue, we can expect a lot of countries to see a doubling of unrest over the coming year. And I would be, you know, very worried about places like Egypt, most of the Sahel. Peru is looking very rocky. Parts of Central Asia, you know, Kazakhstan is looking very unstable. So, yeah, I think we're in for trouble this year.
What can governments do to prevent this?
The first thing they've got to do is try and get a handle on food. And you've got a lot of countries that discouraging the production of food by, for example, not allowing people to export it. Or in Tunisia, all the farmers are required to sell their wheat to the government for a very low price. And the idea is to keep prices low. But what it actually does is it means that the farmers don't have any incentive to plant more. And I talk to farmers out in the fields who say, yeah, the land is great. We can very easily grow more. But the government gives us 1/5 of the world price for wheat. So it's just not worth our while growing anymore. That kind of stuff has to stop.
Robert, this all sounds kind of bleak. Is there any optimism?
Yes, the world can adapt to the food shortages and the fuel shortages, and it will adapt. But the problem is the short term. It's very difficult for people to be short of food for any period of time at all. So it's looking like an emergency.
Robert Guest is The Economist's foreign editor. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you very much.
This next story concerns suicide and may not be appropriate for all listeners. Please take care while listening. Irish Travelers are an indigenous group in Ireland, and they're concerned about a rise in suicides in their community. Travelers have a nomadic culture, often moving from one part of the country to the other. Suicide rates among travelers are now estimated to be 7 times higher than the rest of the Irish population. Traveler groups say the Irish government needs to take responsibility for what's happening to their community. Our Europe correspondent Orla Barry has more.
Mags Casey has lost count of the number of funerals she's been to over the last few years. Casey is a member of the traveller community from Limerick in the southwest of Ireland. And several of those funerals have been in her own family.
29 members of my family died through suicide.
Casey tells me she struggles to deal with the impact of so many deaths.
It's very, very difficult. You know, as women, we try and keep families as good as possible together as one can do, you know, but it's an awful lot of trauma for individual to experience.
Casey works with the National Traveller Mental Health Network. The group raises awareness about mental health issues and provides support and counselling to Irish travellers. But right now, Casey says, it feels like suicide has become normalised within her community.
I mean, most of the time our kids spend most of their life in graveyards rather than playgrounds.
Casey worries about her own children too. She has 8 boys, aged between 10 and 28.
None of our families are safe. None of us, even I as a mother, I'm not safe. No one is safe from dying through suicide in our community. No one.
Travellers are considered one of the most marginalised communities in Ireland. More than 50% of travellers leave school by the age of 15, and unemployment is a big problem. Patrick Riley is with Pavi Point, a group that campaigns for travellers' rights in Ireland. He says it's not just the lack of an educational qualification that's stopping travellers from getting a job.
We have young travellers in particular who have told me, I can't get work, I'm filling out application forms, I'm asking my settled friends, can I use their address? Because if I put where I live, it's a well-known traveller halting site.
Many travellers live in halting sites. They're essentially campsites funded by the local authorities. Riley says many bosses refuse to hire travellers once they realise where they come from. And he says this type of discrimination is deeply embedded in Irish society.
It's not just your right, I'm being followed around the shop here by security. We have seen cases where there's institutional racism, historical racism. It's still very much there.
And Riley says travellers notice this discrimination from a really young age. Bernard Joyce, a traveller living in Kells in the east of Ireland, says it often starts when kids first go to school.
When your friends are having their play dates, and as you as a child are being left out of that, it's so kind of like subtle, but it's gradually beating you down.
Joyce, who's director of the Irish Traveller Movement, has 6 children. They range in age from 2 to 18. And like Max Casey, he's anxious.
I'm so worried on a personal level for my own children. And I worry really for their future. I'm so concerned that I've taken action now to put them in programs in terms of health and well-being. Because I'm thinking, like, how are they going to cope?
Joyce pays for those after-school programs, but he says this is something the Irish government could easily stump up the cash for. He also wants to see traveller culture included as part of the Irish school curriculum. In 2017, the then Irish Prime Minister, Enda Kenny, formally recognised travellers as an ethnic minority for the first time.
As Taoiseach, I now wish to formally recognise travellers as a distinct ethnic group within the Irish nation.
Bernard Joyce says he had high hopes that things would get much better for Irish travellers after that, but he says it made no real difference. Last month, hundreds of travellers protested outside the Parliament in Ireland. They called on the government to draw up a mental health strategy specifically aimed at their community. Hugh Friel with the Donegal Travellers Group was among them.
We need support, we need guidance, we need influence from this government, and we need funding to tackle the mental health issues and suicide rates that's happening within the community at present.
Mags Casey was there too. She called for a meeting with the Irish Prime Minister, but so far she says she's gotten no response. But Patrick Riley with Pavy Point says there has been some progress. A government minister told him recently that a health action plan aimed specifically at travellers was in the works and it would be published in September. Now Riley says, we just want an assurance that the plan will be implemented and that travellers will be involved every step of the way.
Who knows travellers better than travellers themselves is what I always say.
For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
If you or someone you know is feeling suicidal, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline can help. Call 800-273-TALK. That's 800-273-8255. Russia's invasion of Ukraine is highlighting the role of Ukrainian women in wartime, with women making up more than 15% of Ukraine's fighting force. For many decades, women in Ukraine have played key roles in the country's agriculture economy and in business, lending a sort of built-in feminism to everyday life. And going far back into Ukrainian history, social psychologist Sofia Moskalenko argues there are deep cultural roots to Ukrainians' ideas about feminism. She was born in Ukraine and does research at Georgia State University in Atlanta. Sofia, what are the roots of Ukrainian feminism? I mean, how does the country compare to some of its neighbors in Eastern Europe?
Traditionally, because Ukrainian lands have been so fertile, women there could survive and indeed thrive without having to rely on a man. And so the culture evolved to accommodate it. So, for example, young women had a lot of say in whom they married. And it was quite common in Ukrainian folklore to feature single women living by themselves and, you know, not needing to be rescued or marry, which is quite different than, for example, traditional Russian culture with much harsher climate and therefore different needs that women had.
I wonder whether women's roles and attitudes towards women are strikingly different in Ukraine compared to Russia.
My experience, having grown up in Ukraine, has always been that, you know, women had a lot of say in their own affairs. There were even jokes in the former Soviet Union about Ukrainian women and how outspoken they were and how other cultures within the Soviet Union sometimes had to adjust to Ukrainian women's ways of expressing themselves. And like I said, I think a lot of this has roots in the historical traditions, including the Ukrainian military, the Cossacks, which was gender segregated. So men went to serve in the army. They volunteered to serve in this Ukrainian army, and women stayed in their villages and lived without men for extended periods of time, which gave them experience of independence. And so I think the ideas about freedom, including freedom for women, historically have been very different in Ukraine than they were in Russia. And having experienced Russia as an adult, you know, I've grown up in Ukraine and I started really visiting Russia as an adult. It is something that one can feel in relationships among couples and just in the way that women are treated in general.
Historically, I understand one contributing factor to women's empowerment in Ukraine was the lack of a dowry system there. Is that true?
Yes. The land being so fertile, fathers didn't have to trade their daughters for cattle or for grain, and therefore they allowed the daughters some say in whom they chose as their groom. In fact, there was this tradition in Ukraine for a young woman who was on the market, so to speak, to store pumpkins. And in the fall, when the season for marriage proposals came, if a groom's family came to offer his hand in marriage and the young woman was not interested, to kind of allow them to save face, instead of saying no, she would bring out a pumpkin. So there's an expression in Ukrainian, to get a pumpkin, which means to get rejected by a woman you're interested in. Ukrainian women had freedom. And, you know, if they didn't have a man, it was okay. The family was not going to starve having an extra mouth to feed that year.
I know we're in the middle of a war, but what barriers, though, do women still face in Ukraine in terms of rights and respect?
Ironically, I think they face somewhat fewer barriers in Ukraine than women face in the United States at the moment.
Really?
Well, women have autonomy over their body. If they want to have an abortion, they can do so. There are a lot of women in high offices in Ukraine and always have been. I am looking forward to seeing how this war changes the military structure. I really hope that we will see women entering position of power and maybe women generals in the Ukrainian army after this war.
I'm curious whether the Soviet system of gender roles made an imprint on Ukrainians. I mean, the Soviet Union kind of ruled over Ukraine for quite a long time.
It did rule over Ukraine for different amounts of time. So in eastern Ukraine, something like 70 years. In western Ukraine, something like 40 years. But the Soviet Union provided so many opportunities for childcare. You know, we had preschools that were fully subsidized, and after school that was very affordable. In the summer, there were these sleepaway camps that anybody and everybody could send their kids there, which again offered opportunities for women to work or do whatever.
Have those changes that occurred under the Soviet system, have they carried on to today in terms of expectations of women working and childcare available and all those things?
Yes, I think some of the things that started out as maybe possibly oppressive, with the overwhelming demand on the Soviet person to contribute to, you know, the economy, they ended up bearing some positive fruits in the sense that generations of people grew up with expectations that women can and should have careers and get education and be part of the workforce and not just be confined to motherhood and homemaking.
You argue that Ukraine is a good place to be a woman, but during the war, the country hasn't allowed men of fighting age to leave, which seems like an inherently gendered way of looking at who can protect the country. How has that impacted equality or women's rights?
I think this war caught a lot of people in Ukraine and around the world by surprise, and we're all figuring it out as we go. A lot of women did join the fighting forces, and a lot of women are contributing to the war effort in other ways by volunteering, by raising funds, and buying equipment that's necessary for soldiers on the front line, by working as medics and so on. I feel like, you know, war is just such a hard thing to figure out that some of the fundamental questions of gender equality, you know, are even harder to figure out during the war than they are outside of war.
Social psychologist Sofia Moskalenko was born in Ukraine. She does research at Georgia State University in Atlanta. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
It's been a long week of news. We wouldn't fault you for missing a few things. Head to theworld.org to catch up on major headlines and some of the feature stories you might have missed. From global perspectives on abortion rights to India's religious tensions to a new way of learning Haitian Creole. Those stories and more on our website, theworld.org. And join us here on Monday for a holiday edition of The World about life, liberty, and music around the globe. how the spirit of freedom rings out in music from places near and far. That's Monday, July 4th on The World. We come to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. Have a good holiday weekend.